We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which this podcast is recorded. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and to Aboriginal elders emerging. Hello, friends. No time to waste this week. I'm running very late, and I have a pizza in the oven for Mr. Louis. That is my son. Okay, and I have to finish editing this podcast before The Block is on TV because my friends are on it, Andy and Deb. I really hope they win. Hello and thank you to the following people. Anne Natale, I think, or is it Natal? Or is it Natale? Natal. Kim Lamb. I used to know a Kim Lamb. Are you the same Kim Lamb with blonde hair? Don't know. It's nice if it is, and it's nice if it's not. It's all night. Shut up. Shush. There's pizza in the oven. Kate Ross. Mark Bampton. Kirsten Rizos. Rizos. Jeremy. That one's easy. Andrea Willis. Marcus Ribbons. Gosh, that's festive. Lucky you, Marcus. Anna Sholem. Lee Abbott. Matthew Riches. Leah Griffiths. Leanne Klein-Schipworst. Shit, eh? That's good, isn't it? Leanne Klein-Schipworst. Samantha Fort. Samantha Gronbeck. Pania Turner. Ashley Blazes. It's good. Stella Dezotti. Jess Freeman. Dylan. Alicia. Matthew Jarrett. I can smell cheese. Ross Harnish. Amanda Brooke. Katie Delaney. Ali Allen. Because he won't eat it if it's burnt, and then we'll argue. Marianne Gillette. Pat. Juanita Martin, Jen Palmer, Michelle Falls, Karen Brocate, or is it Brockett, or is it Brockette? If I were you, I'd go Brockette, because why wouldn't you? Bruce Williamson, Nicole Allen, ooh, Teasy7592, Teasy7592, that's terrific. Red Corvette, bloody love it. Or is it Ready Corvette? Because you've spelt it R-E-D-D-E, Corvette. Hannah Morgan, Deb Hopkins, Jane Pavlovic, or Pavlovich. I'd go Pavlovich because I'm a purist. Lorraine Abbing. Terrific. Thank you. Tops. Pizza time for the kid. You get it. Okay, on with the show. The following podcast contains content of a graphic, violent nature and is not suitable for children.
Their marriage was already fracturing. There he was in court taking out an apprehended violence order against his own wife. And I was thinking, oh my God, you are actually a murderer and you're telling a court you are afraid of your wife?
Legendary Sydney Morning Herald journalist Kate McClymont specialises in the dangerous business of exposing corruption. Whether it be in the world of politics, banking, sport, unionism or organised crime, Kate is fearless in her pursuit of the truth. She's been inducted into the Australian Media Hall of Fame, won the Stella Award, 3 Kennedy Awards, and Kate won her 6th and 7th Walkley Awards in 2018 for breaking the Don Burke sexual harassment story. But she joins us today to talk about her new book, Dead Man Walking, the complete story of the lives and shoddy business deals of Michael McGurk and Ron Cotty's medic.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb. Come with us as we go beyond the news cycle to find out how people become killers, how people become victims, and what happens next.
For various reasons which will become apparent, Kate McClymont was well acquainted with colourful Sydney businessman Michael McGurk when he was murdered with a single gunshot to the head outside his family home in Cremorne in 2009. While his eldest daughter delivered a eulogy at his funeral, describing him as a great businessman, others who knew McGurk described him as an extortionist, a fraudster, and an arsonist. One thing for sure is that this is an extraordinary story, told by one of the great storytellers. We started off by asking Kate how she came to know so many of the people involved in this case.
When you've been a journalist for a while, it's amazing how stories that you first wrote about 15 years ago, elements of that story come back later on, or, you know, people who've done one thing, generally people who have done one criminal thing, it's not the only thing that they've ever done.
Yeah, right. Even in this case, because this case sort of seems to be, there seem to be a lot of people in this case who weren't very good at their criminal things and, you know, it was kind of a lot of suburban people involved, amateur people involved.
Well, exactly. And you sort of think that if the people who actually did the murder of Michael McGuirk, and we're talking about a man who was shot in suburban Cremorne in his Mercedes-Benz with his 9-year-old son in the car, they got away with it for about a year. And in fact, the mastermind was not jailed until 9 years after that murder was committed. And at first you think it's because they're of superior skills, yeah. But then you realise that they were in fact a bunch of bumbling idiots. And it was amazing that they got away with it for so long. I think why they did in this case was that the victim, Michael McGuirk, had a whole raft of people who would happily have seen him dead. So the police, for instance, at the time of his death, he was actually trying to blackmail the Sultan of Brunei. We're talking about one of the richest men in the world. And I would love to tell you what that blackmail was related to, but the Sultan has got a worldwide suppression order on the details of that case. Yeah, so you can imagine the complexity of the police investigation, because you have to keep in mind as a police officer that there's going to be a court case. And the first thing the defence is going to do is to say, well, have you ruled out X? Have you ruled out Y? So the police have to establish that all the other people who might have wanted him dead had alibis, or in fact that they didn't do it.
Kate, who was this man called Michael McGuirk who had dirt on the Sultan of Brunei, for one thing, and had so many people wanting to kill him that when he was finally murdered, the police took such a long time to pinpoint who had actually done it? Who was he?
Look, he was a 45-year-old immigrant from Scotland, and I think he was basically a sociopath. He had so many criminal schemes going on, but he was a superior sociopath in some way. When I say superior sociopath, he was clever in that sociopaths are often very good at the superficial charm. And that's what you need to be a good con man, is to convince people to go along with your schemes. So Michael McGuirk had he had mortgage frauds on the boil. He had this very interesting superannuation scheme where someone had got information on people's self-managed super funds. He was fraudulently setting up names in those people's accounts, tricking institutions into handing over their money. And then he had got somebody with their ID, then withdrawing all their money from their accounts. He just had endless, things on the boil. But for instance, his oldest son at the time of his murder was at Riverview. And he'd convinced two Riverview parents to go into one of his business plans. When they asked for their money back, he said, let's have coffee down at Balmoral. So he meets them for coffee. He slips them a piece of paper each with the outline of what their children had been doing over the past week, like ballet lessons for one, soccer training for another. And he just said, do you really want to pursue this? So he was a really nasty, difficult, tricky customer.
Wow, that is terrifying.
Kate, I loved the way you set up the scene early in the book. I mean, you called one of the chapters The Sociopath Next Door, and I just found that suburban element where he's like, you know, menacing the school parents so fascinating. But his early years, he just sounded like such a chancer. Like, he had a pretty hard scrabble upbringing in Glasgow, but just hit the sheer audacity of his business ventures was astounding to me.
I know, but you often wonder with people like that, you know, that old saying, if you only turned your mind to good.
Yes.
Like, you just sort of think, you know, if only you turned your mind to doing things in an ordinary fashion. And it's also like these people love the adrenaline or the thrill of the criminality. Like, I think that there's a certain kind of person that loves to think that they're getting away with something.
Mm.
For instance, you know, one of the things that he'd done was that he'd lent money to, you know, a person who had associations with the Hells Angels. So Michael McGurk was already on bail at the time for firebombing a house in the wealthiest street in the entire nation. And yet he is still employing people to, you know, threaten other people. Like, it's sort of nothing deterred him. And one of the most interesting bits I found was when a would-be business partner took out an AVO against Michael McGurk. So the AVO is granted. They come outside of Waverley Court. The person who's just been given the apprehended violence order, you know, who's afraid of McGurk, goes outside, breathes a sigh of relief, has a cigarette. Michael McGurk comes up to him and says, if you think that is going to make any difference, you are wrong. I will find you and I will get you. So literally 5 minutes after the AVO had been granted, he's already effectively breached it. It's like, it's just breathtaking, the audacity of these people.
And it's terrifying. He's like the Terminator. He just keeps coming back and back. And it must feel like there's no stopping him if he's after you. And how did you know him, Kate? Because I believe that one of the encounters that you had with him is that 10 days before his death, he provided you with the identity of his assassins. Is that true?
Yes, look, that's true. So what had happened was that somebody had alerted me to the fact that a house in Wolseley Road, as we were just saying, the wealthiest street in the nation, had been firebombed. And I thought, well, that's interesting. So when I did, you know, title searches, I found out that it was owned by the Tilley family, but they were in dispute. They had been in dispute with Michael McGurk, and now they were in dispute with Ron Medich. And Ron Medich is a central player in that he was this incredibly wealthy property developer, but actually quite stupid. And it turned out that he'd made his millions when he was in business with his younger, smarter brother, who had kept him on the straight and narrow. And things for Ron started to go wrong when the two brothers split up. So Ron Medich, who'd married a much younger second wife, Odetta, they had bought a house in Wolseley Road. But as you do when you've got so much money, before you've even moved into that house, you find an even better house in the same street. So rather than putting the first house up for auction, you know, selling it like normal people do, he sold it to, you know, somebody whose family was known to him, Adam Tilley. But Adam Tilley didn't have the money. So Ron lent him the money to buy the house, and they were going to do a big development on the site. But when Adam Tilley didn't pay, instead of just taking a normal route, he hired Michael McGurk to do his bidding. And Michael McGurk, you know, first of all, took legal action. And when that didn't work, he went to step two, which was to firebomb and threaten the Tilleys, trying to get them to pay. So we were doing a story on the fact that he'd been charged with the firebombing and that Medich and Tilley were fighting over this house. But we couldn't get on to Michael McGuirk before we did the story. And in fact, he was had his bail conditions varied, and he was down skiing at Thredbo at the time, or at Perisher. And it turned out that Medich had actually hired somebody to go and kill him, but they didn't get organised in time. But anyway, so we do the story. Michael McGuirk gets back from the snow, and obviously he's not thrilled about being on the front page of the Sydney Morning Herald, being described as a would-be firebomber. But you can tell the way these people their minds work. So he thinks, right, okay, I've got to manoeuvre this to my advantage. So he organises to have lunch with my colleague Van der Carson and I, who were both doing the story, and we meet him for lunch. And, you know, having dealt with these kind of people, you know, over, you know, my time, I could tell that he was thinking, right, okay, I am going to use Kate McClymont to do damage to Ron Medich. And he kept saying, you know, you're looking at the wrong person. I'm just an innocent here. It's Ron Medich you should be looking at. And it's all very well for people to say that, but you need something to look at. So when nothing materialised, he got really angry and rang up and said, listen, it's Ron Medich you should be looking at, and I don't think you understand. He has got a hit out on me. He's going to have me killed, and Lucky Gattalari, his sidekick, is going to do it. And you can imagine how horrified I was when 10 days later that, in fact, came to pass. I just felt like vomiting when I got the call.
Yeah. And did you go to police with that information? Did you think it was...
I did.
Yeah?
Yes. Oh, look, you can't...
You can't
if
not.
You have information... No, you can't not. If you have information that is, you know, that might be of assistance. But, you know, the weird thing about it was that although... we basically, you know, had very good reason to believe that Ron Medich was the mastermind. Of course, we couldn't write that in the paper, because if Ron Medich sued, we would have to prove that he did the murder. And if police, you know, hadn't been able to do it, you know, within the first week or so, you know, I don't know how we were going to do it. So we had to write very carefully, basically just suggesting that Ron Medich was, along with other people, a key person of interest.
Did you think he did it the entire time, for that entire 12 months? Oh, okay.
Oh, look, I did. I did. But, look, there were moments when I thought, oh, especially when the arrests didn't happen straight away, I did come to think, God, maybe we were wrong. And the time I questioned it most was when the police came to do the arrests. So, as I said, the murder happened in September 2009. So more than a year went past before the arrests happened. And then in October 2010, I got a tip-off that the police were about to swoop. Now, I didn't know who they were going to arrest, where the arrests were going to happen, or what time. So we just figured, okay, it was going to be Ron Medich, it was going to be Lucky Gattalari, and Lucky Gattalari himself had a sidekick, Senad Kamenich, who was formerly a Bosnian soldier. So, you know, we carefully positioned ourselves outside their houses, and Kamenich and Lucky Gattalari were arrested, but not Ron. And I couldn't believe it. I just thought, have we been wrong all this time? But what had happened was that I just think, of, you know, a fascinating part of the book is looking what happens when you don't have money. So Lucky Gattalari is arrested, as is Senad Kamenich, and Lucky Gattalari has organised the murder for Ron. He gets a message to Ron saying, mate, I need $1 million for my legal fees and I need for my legal fees and for bail. And when that money is not forthcoming, Lucky, who suffers severely from claustrophobia, realises that he had just been left to deal with this himself. So that's when he started speaking, and it was on his evidence that they were able to arrest Ron Medich himself.
We always say that all roads in Melbourne crime lead to Ron Idles, and all roads in Sydney crime lead to someone else. Can you remember who? Well, he's about to pop up in this story after the break. Coming up on Australian True Crime, some classic characters enter the fray. But first, Emily raises a tough question with our guest, the author of Dead Man Walking, legendary journalist Kate McClymont.
Were you ever scared, Kate, when you were doing this? Because you report on some really full-on corruption cases and you delve into the murky world of crime. Were you ever scared?
Look, I was apprehensive because within about a week of the murder, I had a death threat delivered to my home address. And look, you're more worried about what might happen to your family, whether now that they know where you live, you know, could they do anything? But at the same time, you have to tell yourself that you can't be ruled by threats, because then you might as well not do your job. So you have to put those to the back of your mind. And I always think of one of my police contacts once said to me, Kate, it's the people who don't threaten you are the ones that you really have to be worried about.
Yeah.
So, oh, yes. Wow.
Good point. Okay. Hold on to that.
Yeah.
And I do think that if somebody actually wanted to kill you, they would. It's, you know, they could follow you, they could wait for you outside your work. And I just think if they did, it would be very bad for business, for their business.
Yeah, absolutely. It doesn't tend to happen very often in our country for various reasons.
Exactly.
We've got to hold on to that, Kate.
Exactly.
Tell us about, on that note, tell us about the detective who took advantage of this particular investigation for himself, saw a little opening for himself.
Look, this book is just full of the most hilarious and sort of like little side issues. So, yes, so what happened was that after Lucky Gattalari was charged with the murder, because Ron Medich had money, he was able to appeal every single court decision. You know, there was delay after delay. And because Lucky Gattalari was the key Crown witness, he had to spend his time in jail in protection. And that is particularly arduous because you're locked in a cell for 22 hours a day. So as the years went by and Ron Medich remained a free man, Lucky Gattalari got increasingly desperate. He claims that he wanted to get the case on quicker, so he wanted to trap Ron Medich. So he organised for two of the country's most notorious detectives, as in Roger Rogerson and Glenn McNamara, to deliver an extortion letter to Ron Medich. And the extortion had started off at $10 million. And by the time Roger Rogerson got involved, I think it had hit $50 million.
Perfect. Well, the Dodger needs a little bit on top for the job.
Know. Yeah. But it was, I mean, it's not hilarious. It's sort of ghastly. So in the middle of doing their extortion work for Lucky Gattalari, he and Glenn McNamara get arrested for killing a uni student in a drug rip-off gone wrong.
Poor little Jamie Gow.
Poor kid.
Yeah. I know, and the extraordinary thing is so Glenn McNamara's been arrested. There is a national manhunt for Roger Rogerson over this murder. His phone's being tapped, and he is still trying to shore up the extortion bid while there is a national manhunt for his murder. And I call that supreme optimism.
Oh, it's unbelievable. And how old is Roger at this stage, by the way? Both of them, they're in their 70s, aren't they, him and Glenn?
Yes.
And people are still hiring them to shake people down. It's extraordinary.
Oh, I know. Mm. And in fact, at first, Roger Rogerson didn't want to make the trip down to Cooma Jail, which is like a 5.5-hour drive from Sydney, because of his dodgy hip. But when he got wind of the riches that might flow from this extortionate attempt, he packed his dodgy hip into the car and set off to speak to Lucky Gattalari and his cellmate Shane Hatfield, who was known as the Cocaine King when he was arrested years ago.
We think we've got, you know, pretty full-on gangland stuff and crime in Melbourne, but I feel like Sydney is a particular kind of, you know, got a particular vibe about it.
Yeah, but we always say that the Sydney criminals are better looking than ours.
Oh, I don't know about that.
Probably richer too. Because they were, I mean, Ron Medich was fabulously rich, wasn't he? Like, he and his brother had incredible riches, yeah.
Yeah, fabulously rich and fabulously stupid. And in fact, his nickname was Cotties after the thick and rich ice cream topping.
Oh, my God. It's been a while since I've had Cotties topping, actually.
That's wonderful. Thick and rich. Now, there was also drama with a juror. Even the jury wasn't immune, which doesn't surprise me. I would think that would be a dangerous position to hold.
Yes, well, there was problems with the jury in the first trial, but in the second trial, there was a jury of 11 men and one woman. And towards the end of the trial, the woman comes in and lets the sheriff's officers know that on the way into court that morning, she had been followed by a man acting suspiciously who was trying to take her photo. And she was talking on the phone and she heard him say on the phone, yes, she's speaking Greek, and took the phone out. Anyway, so she gets to court and, you know, tells, you know, she said, look, I'm happy to get my husband to drive me to court. I'm happy to wear a disguise. But in fact, she was disqualified from the jury because the defence, Ron Medich's defence team argued, look, it's already been heard that he's had his wife followed, his own wife. This is Ron Medich's own wife, and that he's already been accused of murder. This is extremely prejudicial. That juror might think that the only person who has a motive to do this is our client, Ron Medich. So we don't think that she will bring a fair and impartial thought process to the decision. So she was, in fact, dismissed from or let go from the jury, not for anything that she did, but just because she might have an apprehended bias against Ron Medich. So, I mean, it's fascinating all the ins and outs of, you know, what goes on, you know, during trials that the rest of the jury don't actually get to hear about.
I can understand you would find him intimidating if you knew just a little bit about him. And living in Sydney, a lot of people would know about him, wouldn't they? They would have heard rumour, they would have heard and read lots of things about Ron Medich, probably.
Yes, look, they had. But, yes, it's it was interesting because in the thing, you know, the times I had to deal with him, because when you've been covering something for 10 years, you do have kind of weird sort of just ongoing superficial relationships with people because you see them outside court, you know, you say hello to them. And it was always sort of like a slightly awkward relationship. And I remember once during the murder trial, they were playing phone taps, and there was one phone tap where Lucky Gattalari is heard saying to Ron Medich, yeah, I hear your number one fan is at it again. And Ron says, what do you mean? That Kate McClymont. And Ron says, oh, she's never written anything but, you know, filth about me. Oh, and she's this, she's that. And Lucky Cat cuts him off and says, actually, Ron, she's trying to dig dirt on me. Anyway, so at the morning tea break, I said to Ron, oh, Ron, I said, hi, it's your number one fan here. And he just wasn't ever able to laugh or, like, his social skills were, like, really poor.
Oh.
And, I know, it was sort of, and I could understand why he relied on these sycophants, because Ron's modus operandi was to have one sycophant after another who was sort of like his paid friends, and he would support their businesses. And
oh, Ron, you can't be thick and charmless.
No, that's it.
Come on. And what was some?
I think they found his money very charming.
I suppose.
Yeah, you would as a friend. What was Odetta like? What was their marriage like?
Oh, look, incredibly volatile. And in fact, it was only a couple of weeks before Ron himself was arrested for the murder. There he was in court taking out an apprehended violence order against his own wife.
Oh, blimey.
And in the end, and I was thinking, oh, my God, you are actually a murderer and you're telling a court you are afraid of your wife? So their marriage was already fracturing. And one of the reasons she started looking into the fact that Michael McGuirk and Lucky Gattalari were fleecing her husband was that divorce was on the cards, and she didn't want any more of the family's wealth flowing out the window to Ron's hangers-on. So, in fact, it was her that uncovered that, both Ron and Lucky had fleeced her husband. But she played a really distant role in many ways because she never assisted the police. She moved to the south of France and basically disappeared and left, Ron to face the music.
Yes, Odetta from Lithuania.
Where is she now, Kate, do you know?
Oh, yeah, no, she's living in a fabulous apartment on the French Riviera. And, when they finally did divorce, I think that their net worth was worth about $88 million.
Oof.
But I'm just not sure. I think part of the subsequent pool of assets. So one of the key bits of land that, came to light after the murder was a piece of land out in Sydney's southwestern suburbs where the second airport is going to be built. So Ron and Roy Medich sold that 2 years ago for an estimated $500 million.
Oh, my God.
So, I think even though he's in jail, Ron is still a very wealthy man.
Unbelievable, isn't it? Thick, charmless, but can make
but
money.
So rich.
Yeah.
Correct.
Oh, what are we doing in our lives, Michelle?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, my God. Oh, so clever. We're so clever,
we're so
aren't
clever.
We?
Oh.
It makes you wonder what the seriously smart criminals can get away with.
Yeah. The ones we don't even know about because they're
exactly.
So smart. So what happened in the end in court? I mean, he was found guilty in the end of perpetrating this crime, of ordering this hit.
Yes. So, but the funny thing is that the two men who actually, the two bumbling hitmen who did the murder, one was a national accounts manager at an accounting firm. The other was a 19-year-old kid. Both of those men got extraordinarily lenient sentences in some ways because they promised to give evidence against others. One of them got 7.5 years. Mm. The other one got 5 years. They were out of jail before Ron Medich, the mastermind, even went to jail.
Yeah. What a fascinating story. Do you think that your reportage is done now of this, or do you expect more to come? I mean,
look, I expect, I expect more to come because Ron Medich has another couple of weeks in order to finalise his appeal for the murder. So there is absolutely no doubt that he will roll the dice one more time and will appeal. What the what the central planks of his appeal will be, we don't yet know, but there'll be something.
And as his best friend, I would expect you to be right on top of it.
Oh, absolutely. As his number one fan, I will be there.
Do you have any other stories that you've worked on for such a long time? Has this sort of turned out to be one of your great life's works, or are there other stories that you also...
Oh, no, there's others.
Yeah? What else? I know you followed Mick Gatto for a very long time as well. Is he another one of your best friends?
Oh, he features in this book as well.
Right.
So it's funny how the same, the same coterie of people, they turn up. And in fact, Ron Medich's longtime racing partner, Les Samba, was murdered in Melbourne about 6 months after Ron Medich was arrested and charged with the murder. And as you know, his murder remains unsolved.
Mm. That's right, yeah. Who's reported on that a lot? Was it Andrew Rule?
Yes.
Did a lot of reporting on it, yeah.
Exactly. Yes, so he'd gone to meet somebody down there.
That's right, and he's, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh, it's all very murky, isn't it?
It is all very murky.
Fascinating.
But you're right, the usual suspects, if I may use the term, tend to pop up.
Right.
That's Kate McClymont, journalist and author of Dead Man Walking, which is available now. Thank you for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime. We'll be back next week.